Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Resurgent Railways. First, Alan Matthews from the Portishead Railway Group on the spectacular announcement about the reopening of the Bristol Portishead line in 2 years' time. Also, Chris Hewitt's 26th year of giving free public talks on railways, past and present in the Bristol area. This year, he has some incredible colour images of Bristol railways in the 1930s. And this year, his talk is about pre-war railways. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Art Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer with us, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
My name is Alan Matthews. I'm chair of the Portishead Railway Group, campaigning to reopen the Portishead line to passengers.
Where are you based, Alan?
Well, I'm based in Longwell Green, Bristol.
So it sounds to me...
Nowhere near Portishead.
Well, you used to be up that way. I wonder if you got so fed up with not having a railway that you decided to move to Bristol.
No. I worked on the Waitrose store in Portishead. And at the time, I was chair of the Avon Valley Steam Railway. And working on the Waitrose store and seeing the track there, I couldn't understand why it wasn't open. So I got involved... in that way, because I had lots of contacts within what was then rail track and within the rail industry. So that's how I got involved.
Okay.
So, although I don't live in Portishead, I did work in Portishead.
Now, we've had an announcement of just over £39 million for this. How long have you been waiting for this money for? How long have you been campaigning?
Well, the railway group have been campaigning since the year 2000, so it's now 19 years. And I joined about 8-9 years ago. And at that time, basically, railways were dead. I mean, the government said, no, rails have had their day. It's now down to bus rapid transit or bus guided busways. And therefore, there was no incentive for local authorities to get involved with opening railway lines. So we were campaigning, sort of like banging that head against a brick wall, really. But the local authority and North Somerset Council suddenly realised if we reopened the railway, it gave the people in Portishead an alternative way of getting out of the town. Because there's only one road in and out, one main road in and out. So they were sort of fairly, you know, well, we ought to try and get the railway open. And then the government, probably 3-4 years ago, changed their attitude and suddenly realised, well, we ought to probably look at reopening railway lines. And the Portishead line is a sort of no-brainer because most of the line is currently a freight line, so it would just need extending 3 miles into Portishead.
So where are these terminals envisioned to be in Portishead? Is it going to be, for example, possible for me to hop on a train and go to the open-air swimming pool, for example?
The initial idea was it to be near the Waitrose store, which was where the original, well, the second station was. But because Keys Avenue, a road, has now cut across the old track bed, the government will not allow level crossings. So the station has now been moved, so it's now next to Keys Avenue, which is a short walk into the town centre.
Okay, so it's going to be a little bit of a walk over the hill to the swimming pool. That seems to be the only thing
I really care about. Well, it will be to the swimming pool,
So why was the railway originally shut?
Well, it was under
Beeching. Oh, right. 1963, roughly.
Yeah, that way he's reshaping British railways. And that line and the Seven Beach line were due for closure. But unfortunately, the Seven Beach line was given a reprieve. And the Portishead line was never ripped up. The track was left. Purely because the government thought it might come in useful in the later period for the docks at Portishead and Portbury. So it was left, and then because it then was upgraded to a freight line to service Portbury docks, which left 3 mile off track from Portbury or from Pill up to Portishead. And that is a bit that needs to be relayed, plus a bit down through the gorge needs to be relayed to make it suitable for passengers at much quicker speeds.
What about the frequency? How many trains an hour can we expect?
Right. Initially, the project was for a train every half hour, but the costings came well over budget. So it was decided initially to then go for an hourly service, and where most of the cost is actually in the infrastructure, putting the track down, the signalling and that kind of stuff. So we campaigned for an hourly service initially, because to go for an hourly to a half hourly service is actually a fairly simple procedure. It's in operating costs rather than infrastructure. So currently, when it's open, it will be an hourly service with the view to increasing to a half-hourly service at some stage in the future.
Well, not quite currently. When do you think it actually will be open? When are we looking at?
Well, currently the programme shows 2021.
Why so fast? Why so quickly?
Well, the thing is, at the moment, now the funding is in place, what has to happen is that they have to submit a development consent order, which is like planning approval, a business case, environmental studies, consultations, all rolled into one document. And that is going to go in shortly, now they've got funding. And then the government have up to 18 months to consider it. And then once they say, yes, go ahead, it's quite a major undertaking to upgrade the line and relay the 3 mile of track. But it should be around 2021 that we'll have trains operating. I can't give you an exact date, 2021, but that's currently the programme.
I wonder if we're looking at the same kind of percentage cost overruns as things like HS2 and time overruns. But anyway, hopefully Portishead will be a relatively simple job. Yeah. We've seen a lot of the Metro Mayor, Tim Bowles, parading on television, I suppose trying to take credit for this. Did he play a crucial role in making this happen?
The thing is that the North Somerset Council campaigned to have the Portishead line open. Then Bristol City, South Gloucestershire and Baines suddenly realised that you could have a sort of Bristol regional metro system, a bit like the old Advanced Transport for Avon that was in the 1980s. So it started to become a much bigger project. So Portishead Line is Metro West Phase 1. And then the idea is to extend the metro system out to Bath and down to Weston-super-Mare, the Severn Beach line, obviously, and sort of to make it a much a bigger regional project. So that's where the Metro Mayor came in, Tim Bowles, because he actually has a pot of money given to him sort of on a regular basis to improve transport in the area. So he was a fairly major person, along with Nigel Ashton of North Somerset Council, in trying to convince the Department for Transport and Chris Grayling that they ought to stump up the shortfall in the funding, because it's now become a much bigger project than just the Portishead line.
And how much, I suppose, the bottom line is going to cost a return to Portishead from Bristol?
Initially, the business case, I think, was based on the bus fare. I've got a feeling I couldn't be exact about that, but they had to sort of say, well, you know, you can't make it like twice the cost of a bus fare, because everybody go on the bus or they go by car, won't they? You know, you've got to make it And in fact, in the business case, it has a benefit-cost ratio of nearly 3, and anything over 2 is viable. And in fact, it looks as though it'll make a profit, which will help to go towards subsidising the other phases of the Metro West scheme. But the thing is that the current budget has so many contingencies in it, it worried us that, in fact, the cost was going up and up and up, that it suddenly wouldn't become viable. But they've put a huge amount of money in as contingencies, you know, just in case this happens or just in case that happens. So it, in theory, there's more than enough money in the pot to open the Portishead head bit.
And let me guess, is it a 20-minute journey?
17.
Wow.
The thing at the moment, this is the line speed through the gorge is only about 30 miles an hour because it's mainly for freight, which is quite slow. One of the biggest upgrades is to make it so that it can do probably 60, 70 miles an hour down the gorge. The problem is that the train will stop at Pill and at Parson Street, Bedminster, and then Temple Meads. So it actually is a scheme which will help people in the Bedminster Parson Street area as well as Pill and Portishead.
I mean, talking about this Bristol Metro scheme, you know, the next stages of it, etc., it sounds to me like it's just about repainting a few trains and not really much else, you know, no new lines like this Portishead line.
No, yeah, it's basically building in capacity so they can run extra trains. I mean, they currently are 4-tracking Filton Bank. Originally, in BR days, it was 4 tracks. You had 2 fast lines up the middle and 2 slow lines on the outside. And then the British Rail reduced it down to 2 tracks, which is the fast line up to Birmingham and to London. Now they've put the 2 slow lines in, which allows the Metro trains to actually run up to the Seven Beach line quite easily. So there is they're building in capacity to allow these additional trains for the Metro West, the Metro scheme, to run. So,
do you think this signifies a wider change of heart across the country? You were saying the government seems to have changed its mind a bit on this one, but what about elsewhere in the country? Are there any other lines being reopened?
Yeah, well, in fact, the Ebor Vale line in Wales, that was opened under the Welsh Assembly, currently carries 4 times the number of passengers predicted. The Stirling Alloa line in Scotland was opened and is currently carrying 3 times the passengers predicted, because they run a computer model to say, oh, it will carry so many passengers. And so the government are looking at quite a few, the Borders Railway in Scotland at Edinburgh towards Carlisle, the old, they've opened, I think, to Tweed Bank, and it's now carrying a lot more passengers than predicted. So where they've opened railway lines, they seem to be very popular because people get sort of fed up of sitting in traffic jams and think, oh, well, let's have a go at the railway and see, you know, if that helps. So I think there is. In fact, certainly over the last few years, the government has swayed more to improving railway lines or even reopening railway lines. And in fact, they're talking, I think, in the West Midlands, opening a lot of the stations up again. Locally in Bath, I mean, they're talking about trying to open the Salford station as well.
The HS2, I dare to ask you what you make of that. It's going to cost over 3,000 times, the estimates are, more than this Portishead line. Do you think that's viable?
Well, the idea of HS2 is capacity. Currently, the East Coast Main Line and the West Coast Main Line going from London up to Scotland and through the Midlands is full. So they were looking to how could we give more capacity, like north to south. And, of course, there used to be a railway line, the Great Central Railway, which was closed by Beeching, which ran up the centre of the country. So the idea was to put in another line north to south, up to the Midlands and up to Scotland, to increase capacity for additional freight and additional passengers. So that's where the HS2 bit came in. But of course, unfortunately, because the old Great Central line had ripped up, now you're having to go through the countryside and through towns. And so where the cost is. I mean, fortunately, with the Portishead line, the track bed and the track and the bridges and the culverts are all there. You know, it's a fairly simple thing to reopen it, whereas HS2 is a major upheaval going through the countryside.
Okay, so sounds like what you're saying here is maybe the penny is slowly dropping that Beeching got it wrong.
Well, at the time, Beeching got it right, purely because everybody was buying cars, so people were not riding on the railway. They weren't using the railways. They were now using the new motorways with cars. And at that time, there weren't that many cars on the road, so the motorways were quite clear. You know, nowadays, the problem is you've got too many cars on the road, and therefore you need an alternative form of transport. So you're going back to, let's go back and try rail as an alternative, a speedy alternative to get you long distances or even short distances within Bristol, like a metro. So, yes, I think the penny's dropped that Beeching at the time got it right, but in retrospect, what they ought to have done was mothballed the railway lines as they did in Germany and France, and kept them for another form of transport. And you could use the railway lines as sort of cycleways or bridleways, or, you know, just they should have just mothballed them, just kept them, and then they could reuse them.
What about particularly great place to take kids over the Easter holidays? Can you just, within a sort of reasonably easy car journey, I'm afraid, because you can't really get to these places on the train, you know, where are good places to take in within short of Bristol area? If you could just tell us whereabouts they are and roughly how far away they are.
What, to see a steam train?
Well, not necessarily a steam, but a heritage railway of some sort.
Yeah. Oh, heritage railway. Well, it's the Avon Valley Railway at Bitton. And then you've got the East Somerset Railway down near Shepton Mallet, Cranmore. And you've got the Gloucester Warwickshire Railway up at Cheltenham. Cheltenham Racecourse is one of the, and Toddington. The Dean Forest Railway over at Lydney. So there's quite a few in the area. Of course, you've got the West Somerset Railway down at Minehead, or at Bishop's Lydiard. It goes from Bishop's Lydiard to Minehead. So those are the ones in this area that is within reasonable distance.
Now listen, I wonder whether you mentioned the Radstock one, because I was driving past there recently, and I don't think it was steam, but anyway, it was a load of people there, and they're looking to, I mean, it's only a very short line at the moment, but they're actually looking to extend that, and I think the latest I heard is
I missed the Midsummer Norton.
They've just got permission, apparently, to dig out a tunnel which had been filled in so they can extend it even further. So that's some quite good news. Do you know the latest on that?
There's a cutting that's been filled in, and then you get to Chilcompton Tunnel. So the big issue at the moment is raising the money to dig the cutting out, which was filled in, and then they could get as far as Chilcompton. So, that's another one. Yeah, I forgot about that. The other one is not running at the moment, but there is a group trying to reopen the Radstock-Froome line, which is currently a mothball freight line. There's a group campaigning to open that for passengers to go from Radstock into Froome and back onto the national network.
Now, I probably shouldn't ask you this, and you're not allowed to say Avon Valley Railway, but which of those is your favourite?
Right, well, it has to be the Avon Valley, because I was chair there for 17 years. I suppose for a longer line, either the Gloucester Warwickshire or the West Somerset, where you get a really quite long long run through the countryside. You know, if you're looking for nice country, and so.
Well, they do sandwiches on the train and cups of coffee, things like that.
At the Avon Valley, it's only a 3-mile journey, so you can get the sandwiches and coffee and the buffet in the middle at Bidden. And the West Somerset Railway and the Gloucester Warwickshire have buffet cars on the train, so we can get snacks on there.
Okay, Anna Matthews, next time I speak, I'll have to ask you to do a review of the coffee and the tea on these trains.
Right. I'll figure that. I'll bear that in mind.
And the sandwiches.
And the sandwiches, yeah.
Alan Matthews, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, cheers.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name's Chris Hewitt. I specialise in business and IT journalism. And on Saturday week at 2 o'clock at Salford Hall, off the Bath Bristol Road, I shall be giving a lecture on railways in 1938 and 1939, illustrated with 35mm colour slides of taken at the time.
Now, this is before nationalisation, wasn't it? So you had how many big private companies were operating railways at that time?
Well, it was the Great Western, the LMS, the LNER, and the Southern.
So four, big four?
They were always known as the big four, yeah. They were set up in 1924 by the Transport Act. Arguably the only sensible reorganisation the civil service has ever come up with.
So I guess you'll be talking about the Great Western, will you, being in that area?
Oh, well, Great Western obviously is my favourite railway, being probably one of the best-run companies in the world. But I'm also going to be looking at the lessons that were learned then, which the current operators need to learn today.
So, look, you've just made a wide sweeping statement there about the Great Western Company being the best run in the world. I mean, I don't think many people nowadays would agree with you in the modern version, which is owned by First Group. But what about in the 1920s and 30s? In what way was it so well run?
Well, when the amalgamations took place, the Great Western wasn't actually amalgamated. It bought all the other companies up. It's imposed. It's a very efficient management structure on all the other companies, and got rid of all this. Gave most of the managers of them early retirement, and it was very quickly integrated, which is the key difference today. When you got to junctions, if you were say going to the West Country, you got off at Taunton. There was actually local trains to Minehead to connecting with your expresses, and mustn't get the Chard branch as well.
So, yeah, but in what way was the interwar Great Western so well run? How did they manage it?
Well, they had a very good board. Well, the first big difference is that the board of directors were all non-exec, and they were paid about the same as craftsmen. You know, there was none of these fat cat salaries then. They were paid about $400 or $500 a year, which is about what a top driver would earn.
So the actual executive who are operating the railway from day to day would be interrogated by the board, but they weren't actually on the board, as in many companies today.
No. Under the company's legislation then, it was illegal for any employee to be a director of the company they worked for.
So what was the point of that?
It means that you've got people who have much wider range of interests in the affairs of the company, that they have much wider range of interest to which they can direct the affairs of the company.
Okay, so why have you picked on this period, 1938-39?
It follows on from last year's lecture, where I looked at 1908 to 1937, because it's following on that in the 1930s, things were starting to get better. The Great Western Railway actually anticipated before over 100 years ago that lots of people were going to take holidays by the seaside, holiday with pay. And that's where most people would have fond memories of it. You know, that didn't seem to matter how many people were turned up at big stations to be taken to the West Country or to Wales. The Great Western seemed to be able to provide trains for them.
Okay, so, I mean, we're talking about things like work outings, excursions, that don't really happen today, do they? The whole factory would just decant into a couple of trains and then they would head down to the south coast or down maybe maybe to the North Devon coast, somewhere like that.
Or wherever, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think the last works outing was, I think it was Bass in Burton-on-Trent, it was about 1980. Yeah, but the but apart from that, there's also more and more working people were getting holidays with pay, so they were able to take 2 weeks off and take the train and go to holidays.
So, what was the thinking behind that? Why did managers think that it would be a good idea to subsidise a specific holiday trip for all their factory workers or whatever they were working?
No, I can assure you, the trips are not subsidised. They made a profit, otherwise they wouldn't have been put on. You know, you're dealing with companies that that got no subsidies whatsoever from the government or local authorities.
Just explain what those trips would have been like back in the the 30s, 40s, 50s.
Yeah, well, if you were going from a big station like Bristol or Birmingham, Snow Hill, Paddington, you've got, say, a train like the Cornish Riviera. I mean, that would be run in Monday to Fridays. That would be 10:30, leaving from platform one. Well, on summer Saturdays, you'd have at least two extra trains, and they would all, they'd be packed full. Every seat would be taken for heading off to the West Country, and they would get you there because obviously, virtually every station had a steam engine. If you're doing the shunting, even if the engine you were on broke down or was short of steam, you could borrow another engine to help get you there on without having to cancel trains in the middle of nowhere.
Okay, so your previous talk was up until 1937. Can you just do a quick précis of what you were talking about last year?
I was talking about how the growth in railways were opening up lots of countries. For example, the Tsar recognised, the last Tsar of Russia, Nicholas II, that's George V's cousin. I mean, he recognised that railways were important, and he brought in British engineers to help build them, and they've got some shots of that. Also, as the First World War, it was our railways that effectively won World War One and World War Two, because they were able to get the troops and the supplies to the front lines where they were needed.
Well, some would say it was actually the Americans that won the First World War by coming in on the side just in the nick of time.
Not quite. The Americans had to bring their army over across the Atlantic. That's a long way to bring troops and supplies.
Okay, so you, in 1938, you've got access to some actual colour slides from the 1930s, which is pretty incredible. How did you get hold of those?
I collect them. It's people that, by the way, they are first modern copies, because the older slides you have to keep very, very carefully in, especially air-conditioned circumstances, because a lot of the old ones, they do start falling apart if you're not careful. But I collect them, but people, when people die, collections come into the public domain, and there are firms like Colorale who bought them and put them in a public catalogue. Also, there are people who've given me the copies because they know I give lectures on the subject.
What about steam? Because this was the big age for steam, wasn't it? Nothing like electric had hardly appeared on the scene by the 1930s.
There was a couple of lines in the industrial northeast that were electrified. And just before the outbreak of war, the Great Central had proposals to electrify all the way from Marylebone all the way to Manchester. And some of the electrification had been put in on the east-west main line, which, of course, that carried a lot of coal. It's when you look how much coal they carried, you realise how important the railways were to Britain's industry.
So do you think coal could ever be resurgent again? Because we hear from people like Extinction Rebellion, but it's the worst thing since sliced bread. It's terrible, and if we start burning that, then we should probably be locked up.
Well, they need to check their facts. You have to mine coal even if you don't burn it, because of the enormous number of byproducts that come from it, particularly in drugs and cosmetics. But certainly, had it not been for the Thatcher government scrapping the National Coal Board's research department, we would now be having fluid bed technology, which means for each kilowatt we'd only require less than half the coal we currently do. But I mean, it is coal that has kept the lights on, you don't mind me pointing out.
In what way?
Well, if you look at the winters, the last couple of bad winters, it was, had it not been for coal-fired power stations, we would have run out, we would have actually had wartime blackouts imposed.
So do you think that the revolution that's happened in railway, so that's the using diesel electric trains and electric trains and overhead wires, has it just left steam standing? And is there still going to, do you think, any place for steam in the future?
Steam was abolished at least 40 years too early. There's a South African engineer who called David Wardale, who took a standard South African railway specific and put lots of minor developments on it and increased the power by 50%. He actually offered to do that with a British Railway standard class 5460, but the offer was never taken up. That would have doubled its horsepower. Now, if steam had been allowed to run down naturally, well, we would probably be saying goodbye to the last nine Fs about now. But I mean, the thing that they rushed, the reason that the manufacturers rushed into diesels is because they thought they could beat the Americans at their own game. And in actual fact, that just put our private sector out of business even more quickly. I think the Klingon electrification with all the overhead wires, etc., that again has gone far too quickly, because the secret with electrification is actually batteries. Always has been. Now, the people who shout about electrification should be speaking to people like Adrian Shooter, the former chairman of Chiltern Rail, who's developed something called Viva Rail, which is old District Line, three car sets, electric batteries at either end, and in the middle it's driven by diesels in case the batteries go flat or, you know, it's belt and braces.
But hang on, people don't want to travel across country on the Chiltern Line, for example, on an old converted underground train.
Well, it's not old. There's nothing structurally wrong with them. I mean, this idea that stock that's 20 years old is out of date is nonsense. I mean, the steam age railways didn't find any problem using deploying 50, 60 year old carriages, as long as they were warm and comfortable and rode reasonably well. We don't get some of the HSTs are 40 years old, and the western region could not run its current service without these units. And they have done millions of miles. You know, they're exceptionally good value for money.
You mentioned briefly HS2 earlier on. I mean, this is obviously a massive scheme. The latest estimates, reliable estimates, say that there's going to be quite considerable cost overruns on that contract. Now talking about it probably costing the taxpayer up to £111 billion, which is a lot of money for a railway. I mean, you've already hinted that you think the money could be better spent, but if you were in charge of that sort of budget, how would you use it on the railways?
I would never use HS2 because it's a vanity project. I would actually do what the Great Western did in the 1920s and 30s under its brilliant general manager Sir Felix Pole. Find out where the bottlenecks are and get rid of them. And that's how a normal commercial firm runs its affairs.
Well, you can't do that, though, can you? It's okay if you've got a town on an A road and you can put a bypass around it, but you can't do that with a railway.
No, but there are places, for example, the biggest bottleneck on BR, on the national network, is Coventry to Leamington, which is single track. Now, that'd be quite easier to reinstate as double track. The second biggest one is between Bristol Parkway and Bristol Temple Meads, which I believe should be going back to four tracks. Well, in fact, don't get between Bristol Parkway and Temple Meads. There used to be six tracks. We used to have two on the Midland Line. But if the original Great Western bridges, I believe one was being replaced with a modern bridge, that would allow you to run HST or the new Hitachis at high speed in and out of Bristol, which would significantly improve the amount of traffic you could carry. That bottleneck prevents a lot of people going on holiday by train, by the way.
Why is that?
Because you've only got two tracks when you used to have six ways of getting into Bristol.
I mean, people just don't tend to use trains to go on holiday anymore, do they, Chris? That's the problem, is they tend to either use the car or fly.
Well, train numbers since the current scheme was introduced of private operators, I think you find it's doubled or trebled on many lines. The only reason why you've got so many people travelling by road is because the commercial operators don't pay anything like the full amount of taxes they should. You see, if you set up a bus company, you effectively got a free road because you get a rebate on the oil, on the fuel you consume, which the railways don't get. The railways also have to pay the full rates on all their lands. They also have to pay the full cost of maintaining their track, which commercial operators don't have to do. In fact, if they had a fair taxation system, the private motorist would actually be able to use the roads that his council tax is paying for.
What about your own interest in, because I know this is the 26th year, Chris, you've been doing talks in the Bristol area about railways. Why? I mean, some might even say you're obsessed.
No, I'm not obsessed. I think there is another side to the very clever propaganda put out by the road lobby. I think that if our transport ministry was run by the Germans, I think you would see a lot more money being spent on sensible upgrades of railways. You know, the ones that actually increase capacity and make the service more reliable. I mean, look, if it wasn't for railways, half the people in London would get into work. If you look at the times when you had Bristol Temple Mead shut for, a week or so while they put the electrification up and completely resignalled, how busy were the roads coming into Bristol from the suburbs and the little villages all the way, you know, within, you know, the go-to-work area, which was probably about 40-mile radius around the centre of Bristol's main station.
So how do you think privatisation has affected? It was done in the 1990s, I believe, by John Major. How has it actually affected the running of the railways? And I suppose the most important thing is bound to be price, isn't it?
Fares are going up at least about twice the rate of inflation, which is scandalous. The good thing it has done is because they're... The operators are more commercially minded. They have put on a lot more trains, and trains are certainly a lot fuller. I give public lectures all over the country. The last time I went to Banbury, the big success story is actually Marylebone to Birmingham Snow Hill, which is the old, well, Marylebone, of course, was the old Great Central London extension. But if you look at the bit where it comes onto the old Great Western Northern Main Line, I think the number of amount of traffic's gone up about four or five fold. You know, last time I went to Banbury, I was being met by someone who was taking me to Chipping Norton. A train came in from Marylebone, and virtually everyone got off, and it was, you know, a couple of 200 or 300 people. Well, 30 years ago, you wouldn't have seen that. They'd be getting off clapped out old demus, and you'd perhaps be lucky to get 50 hardy souls getting off. But, you know, you'll find lots of parts of the country where the number of people who've been able to commute every day on reasonably comfortable trains and reliable services is significantly higher.
So one of the problems with the privatisation is you've got all these various layers of ownership and control. Like you start off with Network Rail, then we've got the train operating companies, and somebody else even actually owns the trains themselves. Who are they?
They're leased. There's three leasing companies set up to actually own the trains. This means, of course, that some of the designs, for example, trains currently operating on the Midland Main Line, that's the Pancras, are absolutely appalling. That they're based on the cross-country voyages, and the seats are so uncomfortable. I mean, even a little lad like you would have difficulty fitting in. I mean, someone my height, 6 foot two, I just can't get into the seats, you know, because, I can just about squeeze, I can just about get in, but, you know, my knees are in my face. Then you've got the Hitachis for the Great Western service today. Their seats are 1936 standard, which they're far too low. For £100 a seat, they could have made them actually much nicer. Well, £100 for a seat on a set that's going to last 40 years is peanuts. You know, if you write that off over 40 years, it's it's peanuts per journey.
Well, some people down here have been comparing these new trains that go backwards and forwards to London with their grey, rather hard seats to what we had even back in the 1970s when the high-speed trains first came in, where you've actually got a very comfy seat, in even in second class, and a lot of leg room, and you're not so squashed in. Now, what we're talking about is like economy class airline seats, where, where you can barely move and your nose is touching the seat in front almost.
Oh, that's right, yes. I mean, absolutely. In fact, if you go back to the early 70s, most people travelling from Bristol to London would have actually gone on Loco Hall stock, Mark II Loco Hall stock, which was some of the best ever to run in this country. A lot of it was designed at Swindon, which was the Great Western's workshops, and you know, it was very well thought out. I also, by the way, when I give a lecture to the Friends of Swindon Rail Museum, there are quite a few people there who used to work in the carriage and wagon department, and they would give me all stories about, they had these different designs, and everyone was encouraged to try them out. That's all people, all sizes and shapes, and before arriving at one that was really comfortable. But you're absolutely right about the Mark III's, and the worst thing I think the previous operator did, the previous management on Great Western did, was to actually cram them all up like economy class. Now, Chiltern Railways, they have taken over some Mark III's. They've restored the seating pitch to what it originally was in the 1970s. So, you know, you actually have got enough room to swing a cat, and you can actually see out the window and see the nice scenery as you go, as you head through the Chiltern.
So these are the trains that run to and from Oxford, are they?
Chiltern runs from Marylebone, High Wycombe, Prince's Risborough, Banbury, Leamington, Solihull into Birmingham Snow Hill.
What about taxis? Because this is something else in Bristol here is quite a major concern. We've got First Great Western Company that runs Temple Meads now charging all the taxi drivers. They're getting very upset about being charged every year an annual fee just to be able to pick up people from the station, which they never had to do before. And in fact, there are all sorts of other impositions being put onto taxi drivers. But Chris, the thing is, taxis actually make trains work better, don't they? Because they are a form of public transport themselves.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going back 30, 40 years, nearly all the taxi drivers at Bristol Temple Meads were ex-railwaymen who used to work at Bristol Barrow Road, the old LMS shed. And it means that if you wanted to go such and such a train, they knew what you were talking about. You know, and they also knew the way around Bristol a lot better than some of the current ones did, because obviously they all had to come to work themselves. No, it's just pure greed. Now, they had this similar problem at Cambridge, and one of the legal academics at Cambridge University went through all the paperwork and found out that the taxi drivers had a legal right to have a rank just outside the station on the Queen's Highway. So that's where the rank starts. So you've got a slightly longer walk, but to me, what it means is that the operator doesn't get a bean out of them. So, you know, it's a two-edged sword. But no, you're quite right. I mean, you're absolutely right about taxis help make trains a lot better, because you know, if it's like when I come into Coventry on a busy train, if you've got say 100 people wanting taxis, there's 100 taxis there, so you get them. It means you get them out of the station area very quickly, and the same as the other way around is that if you're in a hurry to get to stations, you whistle up a taxi and you're there within 5 minutes of your train leaving.
Okay, let's get back to your talk again, because I don't think you're going to be talking about taxis, as far as I know.
I haven't got any pictures of old taxis at railway stations, but I live in hope. I'd like a picture of a Austin loader in colour, at a rural station somewhere.
You're going to load the passengers onto a low loader and cart them around?
No. The first Austin taxi, which is the predecessor of the current ones, they were known as low loaders because they got quite low floors on them compared with other vehicles.
Okay, so give us an example of a couple of the slides that you've got. What have you got on those colour slides from the 30s?
I've got, obviously, a couple of pictures taken at the Great Western Sheds at Bristol of engines named after the various royals. and they're still royals today, got the same names. There's lots of shots in countryside. There's also a lovely shot of one of the Great Western cut-off lines near Westbury, and somebody's pulled a signal on a king on an express, and the driver is looking out the cab side, looking very sternly at the signalman.
I have to ask you, what is your favourite steam engine and why?
Number 6000, King George V.
Why?
Because it was the most powerful passenger engine in the country until the Gresley P2s came along. It could haul prodigious loads, and they didn't build enough of them. Colet was originally asked to build more powerful engines because obviously the growth in, especially in holiday traffic, and they were told they only got a 20-ton weight limit. Well, when he actually discussed with Sir Felix Pole, Sir Felix was being told by the Civil Engineering Department that all the underbridges had been upgraded to 22 tons, and Colet said, well, I could build you a much better engine for that, which, of course, he did with the Kings. If the Great Western, had it not been for the 1928 crash, Wall Street crash, I think the Great Western would have had at least double the number. They could have used all 30 just to accelerate services from Paddington to Birmingham. But they certainly could have done another 30 to accelerate services to the West Country and South Wales.
Now here in Bristol, between here and Bath, we've got two railway lines, haven't we? Can you just tell us, because now one of them is a very well-used bicycle path, but it used to be a railway line, didn't it?
That's
can you just tell us a bit about the history of how come there's now only one where there used to be two? A lot of people will look at say, well, having two lines between Bristol and Bath was just a waste.
No, it wasn't. It's very sensible because if you had a problem with one line, you got a spare line. Now, the original line was designed by Brunel, and that was the original Great Western Railway. And, of course, the Bristol contributors paid to have better quality stations. I mean, that's why when it goes through Sydney Gardens at Bath, you see all the bridges and the abutments and the rest of it are done in exactly the same quality of stone to exactly the same high standards of all the Georgian houses. But the other one was the Midland Line from Birmingham, because I think it was originally called the Bristol and Gloucester. And then you had a Gloucester-Birmingham, they were gobbled up by the Midland Railway of Derby. Now, despite what the name was, there were certain trains from the Great Western which were diverted along there, like the Cornishman, which was Birmingham's prestige service to the West Country. And I think the other thing that people may not appreciate is the quality of building of the viaducts on that line are amazing. Because obviously they're inspected regularly, but last time somebody from Network Rail inspected them, he said he did not know how you could get craftsmen to produce that quality today. I mean, I was shown that last year, and I cast my eye along the courses of bricks, and they were perfectly level, so it gives you the maximum strength. There was no duff bricks that I could see. That is a line that I know it's used popular for a cycle track. That is a line that urgently does need reinstating because it would allow the rail operators to run extra trains that weren't stopping at Bristol Parkway. Currently, all trains have to go through Bristol Parkway, which produces a little bit of a bottleneck. Although they have put a couple of extra platforms in at Bristol, which is good. Because it is now a very popular station.
The cyclists wouldn't be very happy about that, would they, if that was changed back into a railway line again?
How many people can you carry on the average train?
There's also parts of that line, though, Chris, which are both. In fact, there's the Avon Valley Railway there, and they managed to share that track quite happily, track bed with the cyclists.
Well, you need a double track, and also there's no reason under the current regulations for the national network why a preserve group could not run regular services on it.
So are you jealous of the Bristolians living up there in Coventry? Because we seem to be able to get almost anywhere in Britain quite easily from Bristol by train.
Not actually, because we have got Birmingham New Street. The problem with Birmingham New Street is it's overloaded. And if you get a delay, it's not has a knock-on the system through a large part of the country. In fact, there is a very good proposal It was the first main bit of main line from the north to London. It's called the Stonebridge Railway, my friend Mike Bing, who I've known, who's born across the road from me, he's the gentleman who does all the costings for HS2, that's why he said the true cost of HS2, that's London Birmingham, is 56 billion, not the 20 billion it originally was. But Mike wants to get that reopened. I think he's got Chinese backing to do it. That would allow all the trains coming from the northeast expresses, be able to come into Birmingham International. That means it's only 10 minutes away from Coventry, and it's a lot easier to change at Birmingham International because you've only got five platforms, and Birmingham International was always designed to carry lots of people because of the exhibition centre next door and the airport on the other side of the track.
Now, look, we've just had the news about Portishead line reopening. Which,
I'm very pleased to hear that.
Yeah, but are there any other lines, do you think, are ready to be reopened? Because there's a lot of talk about the excessive congestion on the motorways, on the roads, and there seems to be a bit of a move to identify which are the most important ex-beach enclosure lines to get open again, Chris.
Oh, absolutely right. I think it's actually the passenger transport authorities that have woken up people's minds to this. Now, where the local councils were able to defeat beaching, they are begrudgingly put on an hourly service. Now, up in the West Midlands, we found out that if on the North Warwickshire line, which used to go from Birmingham Snow Hill, Stratford-upon-Avon, Cheltenham, which was where a lot of expresses to the West Country in South Wales went down, we found out that increasing the service to half hourly doesn't double the subsidy. It actually reduces the subsidy because you get three times more people using it. Portishead should never have been shut, and it'd be nice, actually, if you had if it was reconnected to Western Supermare via the old Colonel Stevens line, the WC&P, which incidentally, although it's closed, it was never legally wound up. so that means that it'd be relatively easy to take back the track bed.
Okay, but what are the other main lines you think could be reopened in the future? I mean, there must be some running north-south, others east-west, that sort of thing.
Well, the top one is the Great Central London Extension. It's another one that's never been shut. It means that you link. Look, the real growth in rail services in this country is London to the northwest, that's why northwest trains. It's not only standing room only. People have to get off the trains because they're already like sardines when the trains arrive. Now, if you reopen the Great Central, you've got a station that's just around the corner from Paddington at Marylebone. It goes straight up through on a high line. The track was built for high speed, so to make it 125 mile an hour is relatively easy. Most of the bridges in there could easily put back in, and it links you directly with the Leicester, Nottingham, and then Sheffield, and then all the way to Manchester and Liverpool, and that would actually bring a hell of a lot of people onto traffic and off the motorways.
So why are they building HS2 and not reopening that one?
That is the greatest of all mysteries. I think it's because Sir Humphrey was given a very good lunch by the supporters of it. It's a license. It's a license to screw the public for management consultancy fees. Management consultants have more power than the unions ever did. I remember jokingly saying at a conference I was speaking at that management consultants today have power beyond Tony Benn's wildest dreams. It's the actual cost of building HS2 is not 56 million. It's 20 billion, if that. It's all the other reports that are generated and the so-called services which have already been done. It's a scandalous waste of time.
So why is it that the country that invented the train is so bad at developing and managing our network?
Because the civil service are all pro-road. and what's even worse is, one of the real reasons you've got so much freight clogging up the motorways is because the top of Beeching's agenda was to shut all freight facilities down at every station. I mean, if all those freight yards were reopened, if all the main freight yards were reopened, you would find there's a hell of a lot of stuff would go straight back onto rail. Because on the continent, it's quite normal to send container loads station to station. The only reason they couldn't buy road is because they can't put them on a train somewhere in Europe and send them all the way over here via the Channel Tunnel.
So what was the motivation for getting all this onto the roads and off the rail then back in the 60s?
Well, that's very simple. Ernest Marples was the Minister of Transport and his wife just happened to own Marples Ridgeway, who were motorway builders. Of course, he wouldn't get away with it today, but when he was asked about it, he said, my wife owns the shares. Now, under the constitutional proceedings then, he should have put all the family shares in what's called a blind trust, so that either he or any member of his family could touch them while he held office.
So there should be a sort of gravestone to the British Railway with Ernest Marple's name on it.
Absolutely. I mean, Beeching was picked to chair it because he was naive. I mean, the chairmanship of BR was originally offered to the chairman of Courtaulds, Sir Frank Kirton. Sir Frank said that he would only accept the job if he could bring his own team of accountants with him. Now, most of his accountants were trained at Coventry Technical College. And they were trained by the man who was my accounts lecturer, Frank Jevons. And Mr. Jevons said, he's told all his students, if you do your books like BR or any other nationalised industries, I'll fail you. Right? I don't believe that the railways were anything like as bad financial state as Dr. Beeching and Ernest Marples claimed. What was really costing them money was they were buying loads of untried diesels that didn't work. If you look at the diesels that lasted the best, they're nearly all English Electric and they nearly all used pre-war technology. You know, I mean, the most reliable diesels were the 08 Shunters and the Class 37s. I mean, when the Americans took over the freight side in EWS, Buckhart, who is the boss of it, he actually had a Class 37 taken apart and compared it with the 47. He said the Class 37 got almost no wear or rust internally. He said everything worked. He said he would love to put the Class 47s and drop them in the Marina's Trench in the middle of the Atlantic.
Chris, can you just remind us where and when your talk is?
It's at Saltford Hall on Saturday, starting at 2 p.m. and that's off the Bristol Bath Road. And it's open to anyone.
Okay.
Even if you don't like trains, you can still come along and argue with me.
Okay. Chris Hewitt, thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Alan Matthews from Port Isfahead Railway Group, also to railway historian Chris Hewitt, and studio engineers Dave Bazanko and Josh Chivers. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. And anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk and on the phone at 0117 909 6897. That's 909 6897. If you have spare time, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website. That's at do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.